Yes, there's that peppy flute and guitar letting you know it's time once again for the Daily Connection here on KDUB. Pat Daly with you and two fine friends, cohorts, and one of them's now a granddad. That's right, Chris is a granddad. Well, congratulations on the way to go.
Hey, top of the morning to you, Patty.
Hey there, granddad.
You know, I've been grandfathered up today, and if I do say so myself, my little granddaughter, Cameron Christine, she's gorgeous.
Gorgeous
baby.
Good-looking
little girl, yep.
Well,
8 pounds, 12 ounces, and roughly a couple hours old now.
Yeah. Well, she'll be turning heads, I'm sure, in the
no doubt.
You know,
no doubt.
There.
My only hope is that her father had the same trouble I had when her mother was a teenager. So, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Children are God's true revenge, aren't
Definitely.
They?
They are, yeah, that works. Isn't that what Bill Cosby said? That?
I think so.
Anyway, guys, welcome back, and another program on church history, taking a look at somebody in our family tree that we ought to know just a little bit better, and a great pick today. You guys were inspired when you thought of this. Abe Lincoln,
this was Christopher's idea, you know, with President's Day and everything, and mm-hmm. boy, everybody knows Abe Lincoln. As a matter of fact, when we were talking about trying to do this program, we thought, oh, well, let's abandon all the stuff everybody knows. The log cabin, you know, walking 18 miles to return 3 cents, all that stuff, because America knows about that. That's the legendary Lincoln. But we really got, you know, parsing through this stuff, looking for, well, where is, for sure, the man of faith who has committed his life to Christ and is arguably the best American. He's the closest thing to a saintly person we have in our history. Gosh, you know, he saved the Union, he freed the slaves, he healed the South. Oh, hello.
Yeah, there's a reason why there's not Millard Fillmore Day.
That's
you know?
Exactly right.
There's a reason why we don't celebrate Vice President Spiro Agnew's birthday here.
Bless his heart.
You know, George Washington and Abraham Lincoln truly were the greatest presidents we have had thus far. I'll mm-hmm. argue to the wall about
yeah,
that with
bet.
Anybody. You know, 24 hours a day, I could go to the wall on that particular issue.
Well, even and more interesting, because they were not very vocal and demonstrative with their faith. You could even argue that George was primarily a deist, which is a kind of God was a clockmaker who built the universe and then stepped off to watch it all from a distance. But Lincoln was different. He's now coming under attack, by the way, Abraham Lincoln. On the left, they say he sold out, didn't free the slaves quick enough. On the right, they say he boosted big government and sold us out to federalism. Oh, my gosh. You know, anybody with an agenda that examines any figure in history is going to come up with objections. And I can't think of anybody less deserving of these objections than Abraham yes. Lincoln. Any other human being in that situation, we wouldn't have a United States of America.
Well, you've got to remember, too, is that when he was elected, I mean, he barely made it into Washington. And the first thing he had to deal with was the entire nation fell apart.
Yes, half his government took off south.
That you know that literally you know is where the phrase you know things went south. You know,
yes, that's, indeed. By
the way. You know, I don't know if that's true or not. I just made that up. But anyway, you know, it literally did in a very non-metaphorical way. Things really did go south on Lincoln when he rode into Washington.
Sure
you know,
did.
So.
Well, just for fun, just to bring us up to speed, everybody remembers Abe. He's born in 1809. And he does grow up very poor.
In a log cabin
in Kentucky. All the legends have at least some measure of truth to them. He's a very poor young man, very knowledgeable about the value of a dollar, very knowledgeable about a man's reputation and thus honesty. The first book he owned was one he destroyed and had to work off the
Life of George Washington.
Yeah, you know, that's the way I owned my first video, was I destroyed it.
Destroyed it and had to pay back the video rental place. Wow. Well, you know, a lot of us got things that way, you know.
Well, you know, he was, as a matter of fact, many of his, the material that provide ammunition to the people that object to his lack of faith come from his early years, because he was full of fire and vinegar. You know, he was exceptionally brilliant, very, very verbal, full of humor, and to be honest, he was really disappointed in what he saw amongst the various congregations and denominations in his hometown, even when they moved to Illinois, mm-hmm. you know, Presbyterians and Methodists at each other's throat. And, you know, I'm sorry to say I have to agree. That was a pretty disgusting picture. And sectarian violence and conflict has marred much of Christian history. Well, it soured him off on Christianity for the longest time, even though he knew he was a voracious reader and knew the Bible, one of the few books he could lay his hands on, practically forward and backward. You can see that all through his speeches the rest of his life.
Absolutely. You know, he also came up in a Christian home. His parents were what were known as primitive Baptists. They came from a real strong Calvinistic background, had a very, very strong view of, you know, divine providence and the sovereignty of God and all things, and living out on the frontier, you know, that was kind of a real almost an assumption of life, you know, is that God's in control, whatever happens, going to happen. And so Lincoln does come from a real strong Christian home, but, you know, he seems to have had an unconventional view. And, you know, one of the things in preparing for this program was I did some research as to the religious affiliations of our presidents, all 43 of our American presidents. And I found this interesting that, of course, the two widest representations in American history of the president's religion is the Anglican or the Episcopal Church. And they lead the way. They had about 13 presidents. And then that's second only to the Presbyterians, which they had about 10 presidents who had an affiliation with Presbyterian. We actually had one president who was a Unitarian, of all things, and then we had the odd Congregationalist and Dutch Reformed and all that. But those were the
first Catholic with Kennedy.
Kennedy was, of course, the first Catholic. But it's interesting to realize, as I was going through and doing the research, that out of all the presidents, the only president who no historian could name a religious affiliation with was Abraham Lincoln.
Is that something?
Even Thomas Jefferson. Even though we know that he had a fairly, you know, he was definitely a deist, and we know that he had a fairly unconventional view of the faith, even Thomas Jefferson had a religious affiliation. But nothing could be found out about Abraham Lincoln's religious affiliation.
One thing that Lincoln said was that late in his life, if I could find a church over whose altar was inscribed the single doctrine, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself, I would join that church with all my heart. And I think that sums up where he was. He just was not a guy that was willing to sign on for the party line and stand still for what he, knowing the Bible well, what were obviously violations of Christ's commands in the behavior of Christians all around him. And in that day and age, truthfully, Christianity, although it was widespread, was largely put to use. It served party purposes. Even in the Civil War itself, you had all the preachers in the North saying, God is with us, he's going to smite the rebel scum. And down south, you had all the preachers saying, God is with us, he's going to smite the northern scum. And one of the really unique things about Lincoln was very early in the Civil War, he began to realize, my gosh, God doesn't give a hoot about our little petty squabbles. He's operating on whole new levels. He was such a deep man. By the time, it was kind of a surprise that he was elected to the presidency at all. He was kind of obscure.
Mm-hmm. He was about a third dark horse candidate or something like that?
He was not a dark horse candidate, but this was back. I took a tour of Chicago a couple of years ago, and we went by this building that you'd never even know what it was in the early days, but it was a major landmark in Chicago during Lincoln's time. It was called the Wigwam, and it was this big brick building, and that was where they held the Republican National Convention in Chicago the summer of 1860, and Lincoln was nominated as the Republican nominee on the 60th ballot.
It
was back in the days when, you know, a convention really, you know, was not just a PR thing, but I mean, things were up for grabs, but it took 60 ballots, but Lincoln was finally put forth as the presidential candidate.
One of the things that made him unpopular and almost cost him that nomination was the fact that he was against slavery.
Yeah, and he had supported, prior to even
Absolutely.
His presidential candidacy, had supported anti-slavery candidates and made speeches all over the United States.
Yeah, so in answer to the critics, I mean, anybody that had been even remotely more against slavery than Lincoln stood zero chance of having any part in this government. So the fact that Lincoln was elected almost really is a miracle. And of course, as Christopher said, within 3, 4, maybe 5 weeks, they're firing on Fort Sumter as soon as they hear he's been inaugurated, and the Civil War is off and running. And at the beginning, nobody really had any idea. And just for fun, let's do a quick synopsis of the Civil War. Slavery was the issue.
Sure
bottom line, You know, we all know that today. I mean, it had been cancer eating away at the South since the signing of the Declaration.
Absolutely.
Without a compromise on slavery, there would be no Declaration of Independence. No United States.
Can I interject also, because I don't know if a lot of people are aware of this, is this was something that the Founding Fathers, in 1792 is when they actually were doing the Constitutional Congress.
1787.
Okay, well, within a few years. Yeah. That's not bad. Broad
quibble. I only know because I'm reading it right now.
Anyway, all right. So anyway, one of the things, though, that maybe a lot of people don't realize is even the Founding Fathers realized that slavery was an issue and that there was an incredible logical and moral inconsistency with having slavery in a nation in which we say that all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't come to an agreement, and they realized there was a necessity for drawing our nation together under a constitution. And so as a compromise in getting the constitution together, they agreed by 1820 that they would readdress this issue. And it was tried to be forced.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to think about the fact that this is something that was long overdue.
We're talking about the white elephant in the middle of the living room
that no one wanted to talk about. But the fact is the Founding Fathers were struggling with this.
Now, this leads us to another really important perception. Was the issue, because you hear back and forth, you know, that, oh, slavery caused a civil war. No, it was state rights and all that stuff. It was slavery, and yet there were only a few 10,000-20,000 people who actively, out of the millions of human beings involved in the Civil War in America, there weren't that many. Most people did not perceive that slavery was the issue. They really did. It had been building up, and all the conflicts came about as a result of small localized conflicts over states' rights, over imagined insults, commercial manipulation by the North. So when you hear someone say that it was about state rights, understand that that is how the vast majority of Americans, North and South, perceived the Civil War. It was about preserving the Union on the North, and it was about preserving states' rights on the South. The fact is that at the bottom, it was the cancer of slavery that caused everything.
You know,
and eventually everybody realized that.
When I went to Gettysburg last year, I hired a very, very intense guide that knew everything. And he said, if you want to know, he said, the real issue, he said, if you talk to a Southerner, a Southerner will say it was about slavery. Mm-hmm. A Northerner will say it's about states' rights. But he says, if you look at the end of the reality is the whole war was about slavery and everybody knew about it. I thought that was an interesting insight. Depending on whose side of that Mason-Dixon line,
the Northerner,
said it was states' rights. No, the Northerner said,
sure?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. He said the Northerner would argue with states' rights, or the Southerner would argue with states' rights.
There
the
you
Northerner
go.
Was slavery.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I love him.
You know. It's because I'm so humble. I can admit that I got a little, you know, a clump there for a moment.
So basically, that's the situation, and most everybody knows the story. What everybody thought was going to be over in a month or two catapulted into this huge, incredible disaster. This bloody, oh my gosh, it was over 500,000 Americans ended up dead, wounded by disease, death on the battlefield.
More Americans died in that war than World War II, World War I,
cold,
any other
war. At Cold Harbor, 10,000 men died in less than an hour. I mean, this made Waterloo and Austerlitz, all the other battles in world history, look like summer camp. I mean, it was just because what was happening, the new technology was coming up. You had rifled bullets, you know, high-powered artillery. And they were still marching guys in, you know, in line. It was carnage on a scale unimagined.
And the level of families, if you think about how many deaths there were in the Civil War, the amount of how that, you know, if you talk about hard feelings, when you think about how many families had at least one or more relatives, that died.
Hardly anybody was untouched.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And so there's, you know, you can see where there's anger that goes on over that whole
huge
issue
emotions.
Even today.
Well, basically what we've got is by the middle of the war, things are not going well. Late 1862, a real pivotal thing happens in the Lincolns' lives, and that is the loss of their 12-year-old son, Willie. Up to this time, it has just been a tough row to hoe. And from this time, Mary Todd, his wife, is really mentally unhinged from this. She never recovers from this. And Lincoln himself is plunged into such a depth of grief that this is where we really begin to see who we believe is the follower of Christ in Abraham. From this point, all that pride and that self-reliance begins to be torn away. and he slowly recovers from the grief of Tad, although he never recovers fully. A close associate in later years said, this man has unfathomable sorrow, more than any human being mm-hmm. I've seen. And he carried that, especially as casualties in the war mounted. He was just crushed by the burden of this. And what it did is it crushed his self-reliance out of him. By the middle of the war, even towards 1864, you have a guy who everything he says, everything he does, visibly manifests his reliance upon God. I can't cite all the examples in his speeches, in his dealings with his cabinet. His determination to stay the course, even though he's got people on both sides, everybody yelling for him, do this, do that, fire Grant, repeal emancipation. He just sets his sights on what he believes God requires of him. And, you know, there's no way. I can't think of a leader in Washington or the world today that is up to that level of grit, that level of determination.
You know, one of the things, too, as we, you know, kind of consider the mystery, really, of Lincoln's faith, because it's hard to, you know, really categorize him. One of the things that definitely set him apart was the fact that in political speech-making at the time, it was not unlike political speech-making today, where there is lots of vague references to
the higher power,
the supreme being, divine providence, and all that. That's kind of been in vogue in American political life, you know, for our entire history. But Lincoln had things at another level. And a couple examples I can think of that is, first of all, his proclamation about Thanksgiving and, mm-hmm. and how we ended up celebrating Thanksgiving Day. And how basically, you know, he came out and said, you know, it's about high time. We've been a bunch of ingrates. You know, God's blessed this nation, and here, you know, we're showing our gratitude with all of this.
Oh, I wish we could read
fighting.
The best things here.
It's amazing, you know, but I mean, it's exactly how anybody who had really had a heart of Christ in them would talk about the whole virtue of Thanksgiving.
His second inaugural address, yeah. He's talking about, you know, the reason this is happening to us is because every drop of blood that the slave master's whip has drawn forth is going to be paid by a drop of blood drawn by
Absolutely.
The sword.
Absolutely. He believed in divine, the divine retribution. And then the other thing was he had a day about, I think, the second or third year into the war, a national day of fasting and repentance, where he was calling upon people to... you know, what kind of, pseudo-Christian would call for a day of that where he urged people to get down on his knees like he was going to do and pray for deliverance from this whole thing, and that we need to repent for the evil, the structural evil in our country. That is not something that is a very politically correct thing to do, unless it was fueled by a heart, you know.
And he was very politically astute. I mean, he was a brilliant man, and he knew exactly, he was very calculating in his moves and everything, but I don't think that touches on the fact that he went in directions that only a man driven by God's dictates would go. One of the single biggest measures of fruit of the Spirit from his life is the fact that towards the end of the war, the one thing he was talking about was, in terms of Reconstruction, was letting the Southerners, being generous to them, run their own state governments. Mm-hmm. There's not another human being in that government, in the Union government, that would have given the Southerners that. You would have ended up with another Belfast, you know, another World War One, post-World War I Europe. I mean, there were Northerners waiting. They were going to descend on there and just utterly...
Oh, revenge. They
oh, my
revenge.
Gosh, vengeance. They would have sucked every ounce of economic prosperity out of the South. What Lincoln did probably healed this nation as no one else could have done. And the fact is, most Southerners are aware of that. Most Southerners, even today, are willing to admit that the South was on the way down. I mean, before the Civil War, the culture was stagnant, the economy was struggling. If it hadn't been for the Civil War and Lincoln's insistence on preserving the Union, there would have been no South. It would have become a pocket of...
it's too hot down there anyway.
Thank you.
It would have become Haiti.
Well, although this still manifests itself, I just want to get in. I went and saw Gods and Generals. Wonderful movie. Mm-hmm. Although it's not politically correct. So if you want a politically correct version of history, you should not go see this movie. I mean, they pray in this movie, you know, they talk and walk and act the way they really did back in the Civil War. It is brutally long. But one of the sad things is they sort of depict a general Southern view of that time. Lincoln is the bad guy. They paint him as the warmonger. And to some degree, that lingers even today, although it's an unjust observation. Because frankly, anybody else would have just plowed the South under.
And I don't think there was anybody who wanted to end that war more quickly than Lincoln. I mean, it was not like he was excited about dragging this thing on.
You know, seeing clearly in war, I mean, he's accused by the, like many of the right-wing libertarians and stuff of expanding the powers of government. The fact is, every war president has had to do that. What FDR did in World War II makes what Lincoln did look like nothing. I mean, Wilson did. Washington himself did. President trying to hold a nation together in the midst of a war has got to curtail some liberties. The fact is, he allowed a free election in the middle of the Civil War. Hello?
Yeah, but, you know, really, when you think about that, that's kind of an amazing thing, because at that point, it wasn't sure there was going to be a United States anymore.
Everyone was certain he was going down in flames. Even mm-hmm. he was. And fortunately, Sherman took Atlanta at that time and bought just enough... brought up spirits enough so that people went with it. But it just, this thing was God-driven from A to Z. I mean, I'm sorry, the scholars can say what they will, but you evaluate not only the situation and what resulted, the fruit of the situation. Read what the man said. I'm sorry, this was a guy placed by God Almighty in this position at this time because God has got some purpose for this country that we just have not figured out yet.
There's a little book you can get, Dover Publications. I love those. They're classics. And you can get Lincoln's speeches, which, you know, it's a small book, mm-hmm. the main ones. And I'm telling you, just about every one you could write in stone somewhere. They're that good. They're that profound. And they really come from a depth of morality that I have not seen since or
before. And look at how short, just what you said, Pat. They are the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural, probably his two most famous speeches, the two most impacting speeches of his life. They're less than 1,000 words put together.
And they were done in just minutes, and they left people stunned.
And they have, look at history. I mean, that what is every school?
Four score.
Oh my gosh!
Well, thank goodness they didn't memorize William Henry Harrison's three and a half hour inaugural speech in the rain, which made him die of pneumonia 1 month later.
Oh my gosh!
You know, there's something to be said for short and profound.
Well, he was obviously had the depth of morality that came from reading the Bible and living. And he thought about it. He was a great thinker, as you mentioned. And some of the believers that I know that struggled most with Christianity, once they crossed the line, are some of the strongest people I know mm-hmm. in the faith. And so that God honors that struggling, and certainly Christianity can bear up under the close scrutiny. But I think you're right, Matt, that when his son died, and there was some minister that came in and said, well, you will have the opportunity to see him again in heaven, of course. And so, surely you mock me. Get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And he praises, that's why Jesus came. And I think it was after that moment that he said, well, then, I don't know if it was a public affirmation, but he knew that heaven was real and Jesus, what the gospel was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm ready to sign off on Abe there.
Everybody
but
should.
It was late, at the end of his life.
It
probably
really was,
last
just the last
years.
Two or three years.
Yeah.
But yet there was a legacy of certainly moral teaching before.
Well, his very last words before he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth was he looked over at Mary Todd and he said, you know, I'd like to go to the Holy Land before I die. And, you know, I mean, why would he want to go do that if he was a rank, you know, atheist or whatever? It's just that I guess at the moment he had a premonition or something that he was definitely going to a holy land.
It's interesting that John Wilkes Booth actually 3 days before he assassinated Lincoln was listening to Lincoln's last public speech, and one of the things that Lincoln said was, you know, we need to give the vote to the black people. Yeah, and this is like revolutionary. I mean, you know, anybody that says Lincoln drug his feet on freeing the blacks, I mean, I'm sorry, people, get a life. Get a job, get a haircut.
Get something.
Get a clue.
All right. No opinions here.
Never.
Matt and
definitely.
Chris, we're already out of time, fellas. But thanks for doing Abe Lincoln. I'm sure that's, you know, sparks a lot of interest for all of us, Abe Lincoln. And we'll do this show again in a month when another person of interest will be discussed. Do you remember who that is?
I know we're doing Michelangelo in April, and I'm stalling to figure out who we're doing in March. Matthew's looking.
Ah, the killer of slavery even before Lincoln. William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect.
Oh, right.
Good.
William Wilberforce. Boy, I hope Chuck Colson will listen into us. I know that's his hero.
Yeah. I just, well, anyway. We'll do that next month, and thanks to Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, both on the staff at Trail Christian Fellowship, by the way. Swell fellows both, and thanks for joining us here today on The Daily Connection. Charles Stanley is next with In Touch. I'm Pat Daly.